all that, Vangelis, the Greek composer who just died this year, 2022, from the 1981 film Chariots of Fire over 50 years ago, introduced here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss some important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to be talking about fitness and exercise and how we can stay healthy like the runners in the Olympics at 1924, depicted in Chariots of Fire. For Catholic psychologist and author Kevin Vost has written a new book with Sophia Institute Press, You Are That Temple, A Catholic Guide to Health and Holiness. And we want to look at issues of dieting and exercising and staying fit and how this all comes together with biblical teachings. Well, Kevin Vost, are you welcome. Thank you for joining the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Andrew. I'm very excited about this one.
All right, excellent. Well, just starting out for our listeners here, tell us a little about your background and how did you get involved in these issues of looking at health and from a particularly Christian perspective?
Yeah, sure. Three main areas are looking at health and fitness. I've been basically addicted to weightlifting and strength training since I was a little kid. I saw a weightlifter on TV when I was in second grade, and it might have been the Olympics from 1968. And I asked my dad to get me a barbell, said he did. And then from a few years later, from about the seventh grade in the early 70s, I've been lifting steady ever since. So I've always been involved in strength training and later in running, powerlifting, bodybuilding, and so on. So that's an ongoing interest. My professional training was as a clinical psychologist, and specifically in neuropsychology, where my dissertation and internship work were at a medical school's Alzheimer's Center. So I've always had interest in brain function and the relationship between health and how our brains function. And then a third area that kind of really ties into this particular book, I spent my full-time professional career doing disability evaluation for the Social Security Administration, both mental and physical cases. So each year I would look at between 500 and 1,000 people's medical records. So I had kind of an inside look at what was going on in the health of American citizens right during the time that we had these booming epidemics of things like obesity and diabetes.
Well, that's interesting. And what do you think, you know, we have a large market out there of dieting and fitness books and so forth. This has become a big issue in modern America and the modern world. What does a book like yours from this sort of Catholic background, what sort of unique perspective does it bring?
Yeah, and you know, Andrew, I've always been a fan of like the ancient Greek and Roman philosophers, you know, that motto, a healthy mind and a healthy body. And after I put out one Catholic book, one of my editors was aware that I'd written like for muscle magazines, I'd written health psychology articles. And I remember he said, we'd be interested in writing a book about the Catholic perspective on proper care of the body. I'm like, absolutely, yes, yes. But then I thought to myself, but what is that? I need to do some research. So as I did, I found that, you know, Christianity in general and the Catholic Church in particular has always recognized the great value of the human body. You know, from when we go back to Genesis, when God is creating things, again and again, it says everything he's made is good, very good. And that includes, you know, the physicality of a human being. And the Catholic Church teaches, you know, we're not just souls sitting trapped inside a body. God made us as both. You know, we have a body and soul that forms our one nature. So the church has always, you know, recognized the value of the human body. And then, of course, in Scripture itself, you know, St. Paul tells us that our bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit. So we really need to glorify God with our bodies and to maintain them, to be good stewards of our own health.
Well, talk about that a bit more. What is the body-soul relationship in Catholic teaching, and how does that then implicate all of these health issues?
Yeah, in Catholic teaching, they kind of go back to some Aristotelian metaphysics and philosophy, talking about matter and form. Matter is that, you know, out of which is something made, and form is that what into which it's made, what makes it exactly what it is. And they say that the soul for human beings is the form of the body. It's what brings us to life, makes us who we are. So both are intertwined, body and soul. And the teaching is, the Catholic teaching, you know, when we die, the soul, of course, leaves the body, and when Christ comes again at the final judgment, our bodies are going to be reunited with our souls, And those of us going to heaven will have these glorified bodies, these bodies that are perfected. So this teaching on the value of the body has always been there in the Catholic Church, both its importance while we're here on earth and its eternal importance later in heaven.
And that's interesting. You go into the book, you know, what will bodies in heaven be like? I mean, you talk about, like, you know, there we'll be able to sort of fulfill any sort of, you know, athletic wish we want. I mean, today, you know, we struggle with people might struggle with athletics. They want to be like a better skier or something. But there you say, you know, such limitations will disappear.
Yeah, that's right. And that also, you know, builds, among other things, on some writings of St. Paul, where he talks about the nature of the body born in corruption, but it will be incorruptible or imperishable. We'll have these capacities for agility. Our bodies will glow. We're going to have all these capacities that are mentioned by St. Paul. We also see them hinted in other places, like when Christ is transfigured in his body, you know, because it takes this beautiful glow like the sun. So the church teaches that yes, you know, we can look forward to this. We're going to have these glorified bodies if we make it to heaven. But great theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas tell us we can also kind of prepare for those bodies while here on earth by trying to subdue them so our bodies, you know, respond to the promptings of our soul, you know, so we can use our reason to get ourselves to eat right, you know, to exercise in a proper proportion. And St. Thomas also, when he explicates what Christ said, you know, the great commandments, to love God, you know, with all we are in heart and soul and mind, and then also to love our neighbor as ourself, Thomas breaks down every bit of those commandments and says when we're told to love ourself, he said that includes ourselves both in soul and body. So Christ even commands us to love our bodies and to take proper care of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess that's, you know, it's part of a commandment of, you know, for life, you know, value your life, human life as much as possible and keep it healthy. And live as long of a life as possible. So that is indeed a pro-life message, I guess you could say. What do you think about, you know, you go to the seven deadly sins, and what's the relationship between gluttony and diet today?
Yeah, and that is a good one, you know, because I did do a previous book on the seven deadly sins. So I got to look at the history of these and the way they're conceptualized in great depth. And gluttony, you know, we often think that means just, you know, I eat too much. And even back in the time of Thomas Aquinas and the earlier church fathers, they described different kinds of gluttony. It can be eating too much. They said it can also be like eating at inappropriate times, just like eating all the time, wolfing down your food. They could say it could be like insisting only on dainty or gourmet foods, you know, kind of a lack of gratitude for simple, plain foods. So there's these different ways of looking at gluttony. But I make the argument in this book that I don't believe gluttony, an increase of gluttony, is the main reason we've had this rise in obesity. And the reasoning behind that is, the argument is that how our diets have changed in the last 50 or so years or so, as we've moved further and further away from just natural foods, you know, as God made them, meat and eggs and dairy and fruits and vegetables and so on, and as we move more and more towards, you know, kind of prefabricated processed foods, the low nutrient density in those processed foods and the presence of things like simple sugars tend to make us hungrier. So in a way, it encourages gluttony, you know, because we're eating these foods that taste good, but they don't supply our nutrient needs. So a couple hours later, hey, I need to eat some more. And on the flip side of that, the same kinds of foods can also reduce our energy levels. So we don't feel like getting out there and exercising. We don't feel like going out there and mowing the lawn. So part of the argument I make in this book is that sometimes people will think obesity is due to gluttony, oh, you just don't control your eating, or sloth, that you're physically lazy. There can be hormonal, physiological reasons behind this that relate to the kind of food that we eat. So the bottom line is I'm saying if a person is overweight, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are gluttonous in their appetite or that they are physically slothful. It could be the kind of, you know, the physiologically trapped by the kinds of foods we've actually been told to eat over the last several decades.
Well, what's happened then to foods in the last 50 years? I mean, what sort of processing has taken place, and why is then, you know, our diet so different today?
Yeah, and, you know, many people have written on this, and I agree. I think the fundamental change, at least in the United States, came in the late 1970s when there was a U.S. Senate Select Committee on Food and Nutrition. I think it was Senator McGovern at the time. And they made these recommendations partly based on the limited scientific evidence of the day, assuming that fat's going to cause heart disease. Intake of fat in our diet is going to cause heart disease. So they recommended changes in the American diet that drastically boosted our carbohydrate intake to replace that fat. So they came up with things, you know, if you remember, like the food pyramid. We're told to base our diet with 6 to 11 servings of grains and cereals each day, and then just work our way up to that pyramid. And many people believe that since this happened, well, we do know that since this happened in the late 70s, that's when the obesity epidemic really, really took off. So some people will argue that this recommended increase in carbohydrate is what led to our rapidly higher blood sugar levels, which later brought in an epidemic of diabetes, and which kind of also kind of chronically left us hungry. Around the same time, the recommendations were to eat multiple times a day, maybe to eat 5 or 6 times a day so you don't get hungry, so you don't overeat during the meals. But the irony is that we were probably better off when the standard was the 3 square meals a day, when we were eating real substantial foods during those meals that kept us from getting hungry until the next one.
That's interesting. So what about like meats and fats? What is the proper role? I guess, you know, I have a traditional image of that, you know, you really got to avoid meats and fats, and that's something you want to stay away from.
Yeah, and you know, and that really though is for many decades what we've been told: avoid meats and fats. You know, I mean, I'm 61 years old now, and I remember in the 80s and 90s when the grocery stores became flooded with products that just said, you know, low fat on their label, you know, or approved by the American Heart Association, though it might have been a heavily sugar-coated cereal. So we were given this idea: fat bad, carbohydrate good, even if it comes in the form of simple sugars. But the evidence never really showed that. There were no controlled experimental studies where people ate a certain amount of fat and they found their heart disease increased. It was all based on observational studies from people in different countries around the world. And it was very, very weak evidence. But people jumped in, you know, some nutritional experts, some, you know, political bodies jumped in and drastically made changes to the way people have eaten, you know, through all humanity based on this weak evidence. And part of that was to encourage the carbohydrates because they believed that the fat was so deadly. And we have seen in recent years that evidence has borne out that they were wrong. You know, eggs, for example, were demonized for decades and no longer. Butter, we were encouraged to eat just the processed, you know, margarines and spreads instead of butter. There's been a very, very big turnaround there. And now we're even seeing in red meat that more and more people are realizing that that was not necessarily the culprit. And if it, not to go on too long, another thing too, many times during these years when they were looking at people and saying, oh, the high-fat diets, those people tend to do more poorly in their health. But what they failed to overlook was a lot of the people who are eating high-fat diets, if they're based on processed foods and fat foods, those were also diets that were very, very high in sugar. You know, so which was the culprit, the fat or the sugar? And you had different experts on different sides of the equation, but those who believe that fat was the culprit won by a landslide and have been guiding us in these last 50 years or so since so many of us have become grossly overweight.
Well, I guess this brings up an idea of, you know, you see the various diets, like regions of the world, like a Mediterranean diet or, I don't know, perhaps maybe an Asian diet. Are there any particular regional diets that have really proven to be healthy?
Yes, you know, just in general, I mean, there's a fascinating book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, by he was a dentist named Weston Price. And he traveled around, you know, all different parts of the world in the 1930s. He made it to Africa, to the Pacific Islands, to South America, up to the islands off of Scotland. It was just kind of, you know, multiple places throughout the world. And he found that people who eat their traditional diets, and they would vary depending on where they lived, you know, in the world. You know, you had like Eskimo people living largely on whale blubber. You had Maasai warriors in Africa living on beef and blood and milk. And then you had people in the Pacific Islands living off of, you know, coconuts and fish from the sea. And almost regardless what the traditional diet was, those people had very good health, very good dental health and overall health. But he saw that when they switched away from their traditional whole foods to processed foods, things like packaged flours and sugars and things, he saw in one generation the children's dental health deteriorated. You know, their teeth were mouse-shapen, there wasn't room for their wisdom teeth, things like that. And they were also more susceptible to disease, which at that time, the biggie, was tuberculosis. So on this idea, yeah, we often hear about the Mediterranean diet, you know, the natural eating pattern of people in the Mediterranean, which is a particularly good pattern. But really, throughout the world, for the most part, when people have eaten the real foods that existed in their region of the world, they have tended to be healthy.
That's interesting. And why do you thinking of this famed Mediterranean diet, you're talking about the eating pattern there, the timing pattern. What's particular about the eating pattern of the Mediterranean diet that's so healthy?
Yeah, the Mediterranean diet, you know, became very popular a few decades ago. And a lot of that, you know, it is based more on natural foods. You hear a lot about the use of olives and olive oil, of fish. So, you know, so it is a healthy diet. And you know, in fundamental, the traditional Mediterranean diet would again, just have been simple, real foods. You know, fish, olives, whatever grows in that region, you know, so, you know, figs and natural fruits, things like that. So the people in the Mediterranean eating that way have indeed tended to be healthy. So there are some good elements there in the Mediterranean diet, but I would not necessarily say that everyone, you know, throughout the world needs to eat it exactly that way. Because sometimes some aspects of it have been kind of overinflated. Like they'll talk about, you know, they'll kind of demonize saturated fat that tends to be found mostly in animal foods, though the highest source is actually coconut oil. Not that it's a bad thing, but it's just high saturated fat. But like olive oil, for example, is touted because it's high in what's called monounsaturated fat, which tends to be good for our bodies. But even something as simple as bacon has a fairly high percentage, close to 50% of that kind of fat in it. So oftentimes many foods that we are told are great sources of saturated fat are oftentimes even higher in other forms of fat than they are in saturated fat.
Interesting. And, well, you know, you talk about, as you've indicated here, you talk about the in the book about, you know, eat real food, you're right. I mean, get away from this processing. How should people go about that today in a modern society like the United States?
Yeah, and I will say, too, and of course, you know, this is not to demonize all convenience food, all processing. You know, we wouldn't be here today if people hadn't figured out how to cook and preserve things with salt. So it's not to say all processing is bad. It's to say, you know, keep your eyes open and say, how much of my daily food intake maybe could my great-grandparents have eaten? You know, did this food exist in their time? A study was done that was reported in the Journal of American Medical Association that by 1999 in the U.S. for children and adolescents, it was estimated 61% of the food they ate a day was this ultra-processed food. Now, by 2018, it had risen to 67%. So more than two out of three food items a kid or adolescent has in America today is this ultra-processed stuff that didn't exist in their great-grandparents' time. So that does make it difficult. You know, it makes it difficult for the modern family when kids crave this stuff, and they also tend to be more convenient, you know, so they're easier to make than a lot of natural foods. So I say, boy, what does then the modern, you know, parent do in a situation like this? Is I would recommend, you know, not to make these processed foods completely taboo or forbidden fruits for the kids, but to try to limit their frequency and just to increase good-sized healthy portions of good old-fashioned real foods too, like not to be afraid to give our kids red meat or pork or eggs or fish or shrimp, you know, shellfish, things like that. And also, well, one thing I know my wife and I do to simplify, we try not to have multiple courses in every meal, basically to have a good protein and fat source and then possibly a source of a fiber or other vitamins with something like either having like a steak with some vegetables or perhaps with some berries. So mainly, it's kind of to simplify the diet. Have fewer foods in the cupboard, but make sure more of them are just real foods.
Well, one thing you point out in the book, you know, some people are really sort of genetically predisposed to say, getting fat. Is that something, you know, I guess if we're thinking about gluttony and such issues, I mean, are there certain people who just, as it were, have kind of a particular cross to bear that we have to understand that, you know, certain people just simply, their genetics are such that they have to struggle with weight?
Well, that is absolutely true. You know, there are the true different body types. They call the mesomorph, the naturally muscular person, the ectomorph, the naturally thinner person, the endomorph, the naturally, you know, heavier, fatter, softer person. And we're all, you know, somewhere on that continuum. And yeah, no, it is absolutely true that by their genetics, some people are far more likely to be heavy than others. And one way they've shown this is by studies of identical twins who were raised apart. You know, they share the same genes. They may not even know each other exists for many years, and yet they find their body weights are very, very similar, far closer than the weights are to their siblings they actually grew up with, you know, who didn't have their same genes there. So, yeah, there's definitely a strong genetic component. So just because you see a heavy person, yeah, that doesn't mean there's something, a moral deficiency in them. Oh, they don't control themselves. Oh, you know, they're lazy. Not necessarily so. There are these real genetic tendencies. But there's also something I'd say on the positive side there. Obesity in general is strongly linked to diabetes. So if you're grossly obese, it's a very good chance you're going to be diabetic. It's a very good chance you're going to have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease too. But certain people, by their genetics, tend to hold more fat on the outside of their body, subcutaneous fat underneath the skin. You know, so they may have the jiggling skin or the big love handles and all that. But by the same token, some of these people tend to not store a lot of fat inside their viscera, called visceral fat, like around the body organs. So you can have some people who are, you know, very, very heavy, and yet they tend to be pretty healthy because due to their genetics, they don't store that much fat inside of them. And on the flip side, you can have people who are thin, who are diabetic because they're what they call TOFIs, T-O-F-I. They may be thin on the outside, but fat on the inside. They may have a genetic tendency to store this fat, you know, inside by the internal organs. So they're skinny, they have skinny arms and limbs and things, but they have this tendency to store fat inside. So yeah, genetics, you know, it's a very complicated thing. It can give people certain, you know, tendencies to go one way or another. But still, for most of us, you know, we're not locked in stone by our genetics. Though genetics may make things, you know, more difficult for us, we usually still have some leeway in how we can take care of our bodies, despite what our particular genetics are.
Well, we've talked about your gluttony, which I find interesting that you distinguish among the seven deadly sins. You talk about how gluttony and lust are considered physical sins, but on the other hand, sloth is among the five other spiritual sins of, you know, like avarice, and covetousness, and pride. Discuss that bit more about you know, how sloth, when we deal with exercise, it's actually more of a spiritual sin as opposed to gluttony, which is physical.
That's right. And, you know, and it's interesting, you know, because I approach this, you know, as a Catholic author who has a deep interest in the theology, but I see too in many of the completely secular books now on nutrition and obesity and diabetes, you know, they talk that we've also often been told to avoid obesity, you need to, you know, eat less and move more, and which could be translated, don't be so gluttonous and don't be so slothful, you know. But there's really more to these. And sloth, for example, in the popular imagination, we often just associate it with laziness. And I quote in there was a History Channel documentary from some years back on each of the seven deadly sins. And on the one on sloth, it ended with the words, if Christian tradition is to be believed, a simple act of laziness can send you to hell. And I thought, if that's true, I'm in big trouble because, you know, sometimes I am lazy. But yeah, actual sloth, though, is a spiritual thing. The Latin roots for this term that we use, sloth, was acedia or acedia. And it really means without care. It means not caring about the things of God. So you could have a person who's very physically active. You know, you could have triathlete, a marathon runner, you know, a professional bodybuilder, and they could be super physically active, but they could be very spiritually slothful, you know, if they're just focused on the things of the body and not of God. So truly speaking, spiritual sloth, you know, is a spiritual thing where you're not caring about God, and it's not really an explanation for obesity. I think even on the physical level, the main reason so many of us have gotten overweight in the last 50 years, even though we probably are not quite as physically active as we used to be, but I don't think that it's a laziness itself that caused that. I think the main factor has been that we've been, in a sense, malnourishing ourselves in such a way that it reduces our energy level. We're spending so much time kind of dealing with the high blood sugars that come from these processed foods and the lack of proper nutrients that we just don't have as much energy to get out there and exercise. So that some people who do try to exercise to lose weight, if they don't start eating right too, the tendency is, you know, oh, I just spent an hour on a treadmill. So then you might go home and just kind of lay around for the rest of the day and not have any energy to do any chores because of those calories you expended.
Well, looking at these issues of sloth and gluttony, is there any evidence that religious people are healthier than secularists if they have sort of this mindset here?
Yeah, no, that's a good one. In terms of mental health, which is just another issue this book addresses, it generally has been found that people, you know, with a serious religious faith do tend to be mentally healthy, which it always struck me because years ago I was a big advocate of this rational emotive therapy, a form of cognitive psychotherapy that was made famous by a man named Albert Ellis in New York, and there's a lot of good to it. But Ellis himself was an agnostic, pretty much atheist, and he used to argue that religion tends to make people mentally unhealthy because it sets up these, you know, impossible demands for ourselves. But years went by, and the research actually showed that that's not the case. Religious belief does tend to correlate to better mental health.
Interesting. And, well, you also in the book, I find it interesting, you apply the seven virtues to your analysis, in particular the four cardinal virtues of prudence, temperance, justice, and fortitude. Discuss that. What should people be doing when thinking of those virtues and their physical fitness?
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to do that. And that idea was prompted in me by St. Thomas Aquinas, and it was prompted in him by something that Aristotle wrote. And basically what they were saying is that, you know, as virtues are to the soul, they perfect our souls, they perfect the different powers that we have, so are health and beauty and fitness to the body. So they're like parallels. Health and fitness and beauty perfect our bodies the same way that spiritual virtues perfect our souls. And they're deeply intertwined. So it occurred to me, the four cardinal virtues, for example, St. Thomas describes fortitude, what some people would call courage, another synonym. But he describes fortitude as the ability to overcome difficult obstacles or to endure difficult obstacles, you know, for a greater good. So I'm thinking, well, how does that apply to exercise? Well, overcoming difficult obstacles pretty much defines what strength training is all about. You know, if we're doing weightlifting or bodyweight exercises, we're trying to overcome difficult things. So there is a sense that physical fortitude definitely relates there in trying to overcome obstacles. Well, what about enduring difficulties? Well, there we have endurance training or cardiovascular training. You know, we're going to try to stay on that road for a certain amount of time or stay on that bike or stay in the pool or the water. So in that sense, fortitude, you know, directly ties into the difficulties of exercise, both strength training and aerobic type training. And then what's another? Okay, temperance or self-control, another one of the cardinal virtues. And we can see how that, you know, directly relates to our diet. You know, to make sure we're not, you know, overdoing it. We get something we really like, we're not going to finish off the entire bag or box, you know, if it's a processed food. We're going to rein ourselves in a little bit, knowing that we're going to enjoy things more and our health is going to be improved if we can moderate. So what are the other cardinal virtues? Prudence or practical wisdom. Well, now how would that rely to fitness? Well, the way I tie it in is, in terms of exercise, you know, it's finding the practically wise routine that works for you at this point in your life. like, you know, decades ago when I was a young guy working full-time and teaching college part-time with two young kids in the house. And there were years when I only did strength training one day a week. That's all I could really fit in. You know, but that was enough to make a real difference. Well, now I'm retired. I don't have all those responsibilities. And at this point in my life, I can work out every day or every other day, depending on how I feel. So by exercising prudence, you're trying to find the right way of using your body that's realistic, that fits into your own lifestyle, and that won't take away from your other important responsibilities. And then finally, the fourth one is justice. And justice is basically, you know, giving each person their rightful due. And the way I've applied that to fitness in my writing is say, well, thinking in terms of people who belong to particular groups, about like women, we need to give women their rightful due. Most health and exercise recommendations apply to both sexes, but there are specific, you know, unique things for women, so we should look at that. Another group is the elderly. You know, many of us are, well, I guess all of us are getting older, but there are special needs, special concerns regarding exercise that an 80-year-old would need to consider that a 20-year-old might not. So we're going to look at that, give them justice. And then also groups like children, adolescents, and even expectant mothers, because we're finding more and more how the nutrition of an expectant mother can have long-lasting impacts on their child.
Well, in thinking of exercise, you know, that's an issue of in modern life. You know, you talk about, like, you know, people with careers and having time to do these things. What sort of things can people do in modern life in their busy lives to really stay active?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, I mean, and there's even different kinds and forms of exercise or even just normal physical activity. And I'd say, you know, anyone, you know, probably can do some normal physical activity. You know, trying to get out there at times, you know, mow your lawn, vacuum the carpets, just even simple housework done on a regular basis can have some benefits. If you're an office worker, you know, the old things they talk about of occasionally, you know, use your stairwell once in a while. It can be an effective method of getting a little exercise in. So things like that are good, just normal physical activity. My own recommendations, and again, this comes from my background as a weightlifter, but it also comes from my interest in research on health in the elderly and what's most important to keep our function as we age, and that is strength training. So I do write about and talk about what I consider the importance of an ideal of every person to do some brief strength training workout. This is either with weights or machines or even body weight, but as little as one time a week, as little as 20 minutes, if a person does that consistently, it can make a world of difference. You know, I think almost any of us could probably find 20 minutes, you know, once a week, because the key is each week you try to make it, you know, slightly more challenging, slightly more difficult. And it really does work. I have a gym in my garage, and my son, he's 35, he has some friends come over. He's had one friend coming over for 6 or 7 months now who does only once a week. He does only 4 exercises. And he's like doubled, almost tripled his strength in that time. So it's really amazing. Exercise, you know, is a powerful medicine, and a little bit in the right dose can make a real difference for people.
That's interesting. Well, looking at other issues, I guess you bring up in addition to exercise and eating, you also bring up you know, the practice of fasting. To what extent should people fast? I mean, what does fasting do for people? You know, we think of this oftentimes, like particularly in a religious form, but what sort of physical impact does fasting have?
Yeah, and I found this interesting. It's something that I've just learned about in the last couple of years myself, because myself, again, growing up in this bodybuilding tradition, the idea for us was, you know, you're eating every 2 or 3 hours. You don't want those muscles shrinking. You're going to constantly feed them. So when I first heard people in the health field talk about fasting or time-restricted eating, I thought, oh, great, you know, just waste away your muscle. And I remember some years ago, there was a young man who would work out with my lifting buddy and I. We would do these heavy deadlifts on Friday mornings. And I remember he told us he was doing these in a fasted state. He hadn't eaten breakfast yet. And I thought he's kind of crazy. Well, now I do that myself now, you know, because I did come to realize that God made our bodies, you know, they're pretty well-made machines. we don't have to be constantly feeding them nutrients, especially if we are eating real foods that have plenty of protein, plenty of fat, vitamins, and minerals. We can go for, you know, a period of hours without any difficulty, without having to constantly refeed ourselves. So my own practice is pretty simple now. I just stop eating after supper and a small dessert about 5:30 p.m., and then I don't eat until after I work out the next morning, so it's maybe like 7:30 a.m. So for me, I just have a 14-hour period where I don't eat. And then I have a breakfast, usually a breakfast, a lunch, and a dinner, and that's it. And on certain days, I have found that I can pretty easily skip a lunch. I may just not like feel like it, so I don't do it. And that's another thing that many people who have taken towards lowering their processed food, lowering their sugar, increasing their real food, their protein, and their fat, often find that they're just not as hungry as often. They might skip meals just because they got busy and kind of forgot about it. And I've definitely found that in my case, too. And then one other benefit from this, too, I mean, I remember, you know, I would go out and do public speaking. I'd say, oh, I want to make sure I've eaten something with an hour or two before then. I don't want my blood sugar to crash. Well, you know, I found now I do great if I may not have eaten for 6 or 8 hours, you know, or more, and my thoughts are even seem to be come to me more quickly. You know, I'm quicker, more alert when I don't have that food on my stomach, because changing this diet the way I have, my body kind of continually burns its fat stores rather than any of these quick fixes of sugar. So many people who have adapted their diets this way find that fasts, or at least, you know, eating less often, has just become a very, very natural thing, both for the body and for the mind. And, of course, that's even besides the spiritual benefits that we can get from fasting.
Well, you know, you talk about, sort of all these weight competitions, bodybuilding. I found you interesting. You cited one person in the book from your sort of, you have an appendix, and you have individuals talking about sort of their individual issues of exercise and health and eating. One woman talked about, like, she you know, she's a very Orthodox, pro-life Catholic mother, and she's regarded sort of like gyms as satanic, you know, like that was where bad people congregated. And then she actually got the suggestion to participate in a bodybuilding contest, and she was wondering, you know, should I be out there like in a, you know, show and with a bikini on or whatever? Is that something a Christian should do? What do you think of those activities? I mean, how should Christians approach gyms or bodybuilding or whatever? Are there really sort of like, you know, issues Christians have to deal with there? How should Christians look at those issues?
Yeah, and that is important, because, you know, and I remember, you know, her story very well. I think it was one of her 9 children that encouraged her to get out there and show that yes, you know, you can love God, you can be pro-life, you can have a huge family, and you can still maintain your body properly. So I believe for a time she did some bodybuilding competition. And again, in bodybuilding, the real fans of the sport, they're into muscular development. It's not a lustful thing. It's not lewdness that brings people there. It's an art form, you know. So the people who truly appreciate bodybuilding, it's not a vicious thing. But again, you know, most of us, though, and I do have another bodybuilder story in there, one who actually won a Mr. Universe contest, a man. But the thing is, yeah, bodybuilding is not necessarily for everybody. For a period of time in my life, it was an interest. The main focus is to glorify God in our bodies, to make them healthier, to make them fitter, to give us, you know, hopefully so we can live longer, so we can be better parents, so we can be there for our kids, be there for our grandkids. But if you do have a body, if God gave you a body that's particularly symmetrical and beautiful, there's nothing wrong, you know, I don't believe, you know, for occasionally putting on a display in a bodybuilding contest, you know, in an artful and graceful way, as a few of these folks have done. Again, but that is just something, you know, for the rare individual who wants to do that. I think that the main reason should be, you know, we're focusing on improving our function, the way our bodies work, how healthy we are, how much energy we have. And if it also changes the way we look, that's not the primary goal, but it's just kind of a nice side effect.
Well, this all this work on fitness and exercise and so forth, and integrated with a Christian worldview, can this actually be sort of a tool for evangelism?
Yes, I think it can. You know, I'm not sure if they're around now, but I remember when I was younger, there used to be these power teams for Christ that would go out and speak to young people, and there'd be bodybuilders and weightlifters and strongmen, and to try to show them that, you know, being a Christian, you know, like, you know, being meek, like, meekness is not weakness, you know. Christ himself was probably quite muscular, the son of a carpenter, you know, walking miles and everywhere. So I think it is a good way to show that. Some people may have this idea that Christians think that the body itself, you know, is somehow evil and we need to hide it and, you know, we don't need to talk about it. We don't need to take care of it. We need to punish it. Well, not necessarily so. I think it was Pope Pius XII said that, you know, the human body is God's masterpiece, you know, of creation. So we should treat it, you know, as a masterpiece and let people know, get the good word out there that we, the Christians, the Catholics, we care for our bodies. We appreciate them. We thank God for them, but we're not going out there to flaunt them or to get people to say, hey, you know, look at me, look what I've done with my body. The real goal should be to glorify God and say, you know, showing our gratitude to God for giving us these bodies, which we can make healthier and fitter.
And do you think, if I guess, it brings to mind, you know, what has been the role for say, like, athletes, you know, to what extent have athletes been professing Christians and thereby influenced society?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've had some real good prominent examples of that, you know, in some of the pro sports, those rare Christians that they're not ashamed of their faith, you know, they really gather a lot of attention, and I think, and do a lot of good. In this book that I have, in the Temple Tending Tales, I have a few, you know, pretty renowned athletes there. I have a professional wrestler and some others. So I think it can be especially powerful in our culture today to young people, especially when we tend to idolize, you know, celebrities, be they athletes, musicians, television, movie stars. So when one of those people with that kind of prominence can speak out and say, you know, I've achieved this worldly success, but some things are more important. And the excess that I do have, I give credit to God. Yeah, I think that is a very, very powerful and important message.
Well, thinking of issues of physical fitness and health, do you think the churches are doing enough to address these issues? I mean, how might, say, you know, your local parish or something take up this issue and promote this more?
Yeah, now that is a good one, because the Catholic Church as a whole, you know, has been behind this for a long time. I give a lot of quotes from Pope Pius XII in this book, and also some from St. Pope John Paul II. And Pius XII and the Pope, they used to sometimes talk to athletic groups, you know, and give talks to particular sporting clubs, and so they would talk about the value of the human body. And Pope Pius said, you know, the Church approves of physical culture, which is an old-fashioned term of proper care of the body that I really like. But he said the Church approves of physical culture without any doubt whatever, as long as it be kept in proper proportion. And then he said what he means by that is that, you know, the body doesn't become an idol itself, that we don't, you know, that we don't overwork so we, you know, lose all of our energy. We don't overtrain so we don't have the energy to take care of other responsibilities, you know, that doesn't interfere with our work life and family life and things like that. But yeah, the Church has long recognized it is important to tend for our bodies. So I would hope we would see that more at the parish level, because it's a balancing of things. You know, does this mean that we can't have, you know, donuts after Mass? Well, I don't think necessarily so. I think that can work in there. But we can also maybe look for opportunities to have some real, you know, the Church promote healthy things in some way or another, possibly promote walks or occasionally when there's special events and meals, maybe once a month or something, having a focus on some particularly healthy foods, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, things like that. So I think, you know, the Church does have potential. The Catholic Church and others, there is a real potential there to help Christians, to help Catholics focus on the real needs of our bodies and do God honor. And to do that, I don't think at all is taking away from the spiritual message. It's not one or the other. You know, we're made as both, and I think the Church can play a role, hopefully will play a greater role, in making people realize that, showing greater gratitude to God, proper care of our bodies.
Well, you talk about vegetables there. It brings up a point. You also discuss in the book sort of the issue of vegetarianism and sort of related issues like that, like, you know, people maybe have objections to, you know, treatment of animals and so forth. What should people think of vegetarianism? Is that necessarily something we should really all strive for? Is that, a total good? Or what would be a sort of a Christian outlook on that?
Yeah, and there, you know, and people could have different opinions, and, you know, and I would hope that we all will have the right to choose how we want to eat. So, you know, I'm all for vegans and vegetarians to have the choice to eat that way if that's how they choose. You know, I also follow some, you know, carnivore people who choose that they're healthiest on a meat-based diet, and I would hope that would also always be an option. But my own general take there, you know, coming from, you know, back from Cain and Abel, we've always had, you know, meat eaters and plant eaters, you know. We've been more omnivores. We're eating the good things of the earth, both in the plant and animal worlds. I personally believe that animal food is very, very important to our health. Partly through studies on aging people, the importance of maintaining muscle mass, the highest quality of proteins assessed through three different methods that have been developed over the decades, three different ways of looking at protein deficiency or the digestibility of the amino acids and so forth. The animal-based proteins always come out number one, whey, eggs, meat, and so forth. There are a few plant-based proteins that there are complete soy and a few other things. But most of the plant-based proteins lack essential amino acids. So if a person's not eating any animal protein at all, they're going to have to be careful how they combine foods, like bread with peanut butter, rice with beans, and things like that. But the only catch is, if you do that, you have to actually take in more calories to reach the same level of protein. So you're at risk, you know, for giving your body too much energy in order to meet the protein needs that you have. So I personally do value animal-based foods, though I also do like to eat some plant-based, you know, usually, you know, things like vegetables. I enjoy nuts. I enjoy berries. But again, my own take is people should be free to choose what they want. I think in the Bible it shows itself. We've eaten both for a long, long time. And each person also, you know, needs to realize that we do have individually different body chemistries. And some foods that one person will thrive on, another person won't. And if I can make one last point on this too, just throughout the world, you know, culturally, there have been, you know, almost exclusively meat-eating peoples like the Inuit Eskimos, the Maasai in Africa, that have been very, very healthy. There have also been people throughout the world with largely plant-based diets that have been healthy too. But so in that case, I think that the common denominator is that they're just eating, tend to eat more real foods and foods that are present in their own area. So they've not been transported all around the world. They're eating what people in their areas have traditionally eaten for a long time.
Yeah, and I guess you also make points, too, that, you know, animals dying, say, in slaughter for meat is not necessarily, you know, it's not necessarily a bad death compared to, you know, animals in the wild dying from disease or, you know, just being eaten by predators and so forth. And I guess you could say that, you know, thinking of stewardship and husbandry for Christians, that, you know, animals and taking care of animal populations has very sort of important interaction with the environment. I mean, you talk about how, you know, a lot of deforestation can take place in the Amazon rainforest precisely to grow soybeans for, you know, tofu or whatever. So, you know, the sort of the animal welfare and environmental effects of just simply eating vegetables may not necessarily be as clear cut as one might think.
Well, that's exactly right. I touch on this a bit, but there really is a lot to it. I do make the point, you know, like sometimes I'll be in my room and at 4 in the morning I hear some kind of screech and it ends up it's been some poor rabbit or something in the yard, you know, has been eaten alive by another animal. You know, so often animals, they're eaten alive or they die from sickness. The animals that we eat for food, I mean, hopefully will be treated humanely through their whole lives and die in an instant without suffering. So we have to consider that. But also, if we do move towards crops, you know, it's estimated that they're smaller animals, but far more animals are killed for the production of crops. You know, the various mice and insects and other creatures that used to live in this land you know, are killed when it's converted into cropland, or when the crops are harvested, you know, that they're pulled up in there with it. So it's not a simple matter. I mean, I do not believe there's a lot of propaganda that you're going to save the planet if we stop eating meat. And I don't think that's accurate. There's pros and cons, you know, to both the plant-based foods and the animal-based foods. And ironically, many of the plant-based foods that are being pushed now, it's not, you know, eat your broccoli, eat your carrots, you know, eat your apples and oranges. It's eat these specially manufactured products that are actually made to imitate animal foods. So again, very, very far from nature, even though they may be plant-based.
Oh, yeah, that brings up an interesting question. You know, I've sort of personally tried them too. You have all these, you know, like Impossible Burger and, you know, veggie burgers and so forth. What is the value of those things? I mean, I've tried them and, you know, you try to like, so I have your cake in it too, right? You say, yeah, I want to eat some vegetables, but, you know, I want to get a meaty taste. I mean, what's going on with those kinds of foods?
Well, you know, and again, my own opinion is, you know, if for those foods to be successful, they have to mimic these natural foods that people have eaten since the beginning of time, then there might actually be some value to those natural foods. Also, there's this idea that if we have these, you know, epidemics and things like obesity and diabetes and so forth, does it make sense to blame them on foods we've eaten all throughout history, meat and eggs, you know, and dairy and so on, and not to look instead on all this artificially processed food that didn't even exist before these epidemics started? So personally, myself, I'm very, very leery of any, you know, manufactured, man-made food as opposed to foods that, you know, as they grow in nature.
It's an interesting point. You've been talking a lot about science and so forth. You bring up the point here in the book that, you know, I mean, science, time and time again, you know, something was once scientifically studied and a particular conclusion was reached, but then later, you know, obviously, studies said, no, that's not really accurate, or there were even studies that were not published, but then we later found that actually contained insights. And you also talk about, you know, of course, what is the funding of all the science? I mean, these corporations that might want to, say, push certain agenda in their own product line. I mean, should we really, as they say, follow the science, or do we have to be more skeptical than that?
Yeah, it does really get complicated when we, especially when we look at nutritional science. It's very imprecise. And many of the studies are funded by major food corporations and also sometimes by pharmaceutical corporations. So we have to be careful. If there is a prevailing wisdom, like there has been for decades, you know, it was basically fat bad, you know, carbohydrate good. So if you do a study that doesn't, it comes out and the results don't match, the peer reviewers of the journal may be much less likely to publish it, you know, or if it does get published, sometimes the researchers themselves will kind of try to discount their findings, explain why it didn't match the big paradigm, but say the big paradigm still holds. So we have to be very, very careful with the way we look at this nutritional science. And at times the evidence has mounted to the point where previous recommendations have been changed, but often that change doesn't get a whole lot of headlines. Like the recommendations on cholesterol have changed in recent decades. You know, we were told not to eat egg yolks and to not eat a certain amount of cholesterol per day. Well, the science, you know, later showed your body produces a lot more of its own cholesterol than what you take in through food. And what you take in through food, not for everyone, has much of an impact on your blood serum cholesterol levels. So certain recommendations have been backed off over time, but they haven't gotten a lot of headlines. So people may not even be aware of this. Like the American College of Cardiology a couple of years ago, with a paper saying that we probably should not be recommending any further lowering of saturated fat intake. But most people probably haven't heard that. The American Dietetic Association just a few years back came out and kind of removed. It used to poo-poo, you know, the low-carbohydrate type diets, and now they've admitted that this is the most effective way to control your blood sugar. So there have been some changes in recommendations in recent years, but they're usually not broadcast too loudly because then the experts would basically be saying, hey, what we told you was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I don't know. A curious question I just occurred to me is, has there ever been any, we're talking about diet, certain religions have, certain dietary practices. I mean, of course, you think of like Judaism, you have a kosher diet, certain commandments to, of course, pork is well known, or, you don't mix meat and cheese. And certainly in Islam as well, similarly, you have a prohibition of pork and so forth. Has there ever been any studies shown of such religious diets that they have any particular impacts?
Well, that's interesting. That brings a few things to mind. Much of the modern research that helps extol vegetarianism, some of that comes out of Loma Linda University and their medical center, and they were founded by the Seventh-day Adventists. And actually, the Seventh-day Adventists were very influential in founding the American Dietetic Association. And they were basically vegetarians and thought that eating meat led to, like, lust and things like that. So there's a religious mindset that is behind endorsing certain kinds of food intakes. So it has often been touted that the Seventh-day Adventists tend to have longer lifespans, and they're mostly vegetarians. But I found there's also research that shows very similar findings for the Mormons. They also tend to have the long lifespans, and yet they are not vegetarians. But maybe the commonality they find from both groups is that they're not likely to smoke and drink excessively, so these other things that factor in. So that's one religious, kind of comparison that comes to mind. Another, I remember decades ago, there was some kind of study, I don't remember all the details now, but it was done in India. And it was people from the lower regions of India who I believe were mostly Hindus that had a very low intake of meat. And then there were contrasted with the people in the north. It may have been the Sikhs, but they had a diet that was actually far heavier in meat. And it was those from the north, the meat-eating people of India, that actually had the better health outcomes than those from the south. So I'm not an expert on it, but those are a couple that come to mind. But yeah, your religious values, can impact your health, but maybe one good commonality is, most religions, will in some way, recommend that we properly care for our bodies. So as we might see the case, like for both the Seventh-day Adventists and the Mormons, they do tend to be relatively healthy, but it may not necessarily be because of specific dietary recommendations as much as other factors, like not smoking, not taking in too much alcohol, and so on.
All right, well, excellent. Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly Blog Talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Hare, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we've been talking about sound bodies and sound minds, physical fitness, exercising, and dieting with Kevin Vost, who has a new book from Sophia Institute Press, You Are That Temple, A Catholic Guide to Health and Holiness. Well, Kevin Vost, thank you for joining the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Andrew. I really enjoyed it.
All right, and for our listeners out there, join us next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.